Chapter 12. Explosions painted the sky. Burning wrecks spiraled down to destruction, and streaking blasts of anti-aircraft fire stitched bright traceries across the heavens. Annerman felt them all moments before they happened, flinching in anticipation of shells that hadn't burst or zipping lines of flak that hadn't been fired. He reclined in a converted gravity harness, built into the crew compartment of a heavily modified Stormhawk transporter designated Scarab Prime. Flying behind the main body of the aerial assault, the tempo of Adamant's pulse increased as the jerking images of the future blazed like miniature suns in his mind. A dozen warriors of the Scarab occult stood behind him in vertical restraints, bolters clamped to their chests, looking like reliquary statues at the entrance to an ancient king's tomb. Lemuel Cowman was dwarfed by their bulk, his ebony features pale and sweat-streaked as he kept his eyes screwed tightly shut. To bring mortals on combat missions was a new development for the Thousand Sons, but in response to their repeated requests, Magnus had decreed that any remembrancers that desired to witness the full fury of an Astartes assault would be permitted to do so. Surprisingly, only a few had accepted. Adamon knew Lemuel was beginning to regret his hasty decision, but as a neophyte, it was only right that he be here. Camille Shivani travelled on a Thunderhawk of the Sixth Fellowship, her mind relishing the chance to get close to the front lines of war. Her normal line of research dealt with civilizations long gone. Now she might see one vanish before her very eyes. Callista Eris had chosen not to fly into harm's way. Another attack of what she called the fire had left her drained and exhausted. Mahavastu Callimachus travelled with Magnus, though compared to the panicked and exhilarated thoughts of his fellow remembrancers, his mind was dull, like a fire all but smothered by suffocating foam. Within Adamin's Stormhawk, internal spaces normally reserved for troops and heavy equipment were filled with banks of surveyor gear and crystalline receptors. Heavy cables snaked across the armoured floor of the compartment, plugging into the elevated harness upon which he sat. Adamant's head was encased in a gleaming hood of shimmering light, a gossamer-thin matrix of precisely cut crystals hewn from the reflecting caves beneath Tizkar. His mind floated in a meditative state, unbound from his mortal flesh and occupying a detached state in the higher enumerations. Fine copper wires trailed from this crystal hood, their nickel-jacketed ends immersed in psi-reactive gels that amplified Adamant's thoughts and allowed others to receive them. His mind skimmed the surface of the great ocean, allowing 8PO to guide the currents of potential futures his way. This close to the present, such echoes were easy to find, and it was a simple matter for a tutelary of a master of the Corvidae to pluck them from the ether. His heightened sensitivity to the immediate future gave him an unmatched situational awareness. He could read the flow of thermoclines across the mountains, see every aircraft, and feel the fears of their crews as they surged towards Phoenix Crag. His awareness floated above the unfolding assault, reading its ebbs and flows as surely as if it were a slow-moving battle simulation. The flame-crowned city of the Avening Kings lay 10 kilometres east of the tightening noose of aircraft. It was a silver-sheathed mountain with an eternally burning plume of blue fire at its highest tower, a majestic creation of glass spires and soaring bridges that appeared as fragile as spun silk. Graceful minarets and pyramids of glass capped the mountain peaks, and sprawling habitation towers glittered like pillars of ice in the bright sunlight. Columned processionals marched their way into the mountains from the shadowed valleys below, their lengths wreathed in explosions and smoke as artillery brigades and the heavy armour of the Prospero Spire Guard, Lacunan Life Watch and Uranti Drax laid siege to its lower levels. As Phoenix Crag was battered from below, so too was it assaulted from the air.
"As above, so below," whispered Adamon.
3,000 aircraft streaked towards the last bastion of the Avenians, roaring through a storm of defensive gunfire and the last squadrons of enemy fighters. Impulsive space-wolf thunderhawks raced for the crown of the mountain, while heavier word-bearer stormbirds and Imperial Army bulklanders dived towards its sprawling base. 1,000 Suns aircraft speared towards its guts, a mixture of darting Lotus fighters, Apis bombers and Stormhawk transports. Adamon likened the Thousand Suns' assault to a living organism, with the awesome force of Magnus the Red as its unimaginably powerful mind. Magnus directed the assault, but the Athenians were his thoughts, the Raptora his shield, and the Pirae and Pavoni his fists. The Corvidae were his eyes and ears. Adamant saw a flickering image of an armour-piercing shell punched through the belly of Eagle's Talon, a roaring stormbird of the Sixth Fellowship, and sent a pulse of warning into the Matrix. He felt the brief moment of connection with the impossibly complex lattice of Magnus's mind, the brightest sun at the heart of a golden web that eclipsed all others with its brilliance. No sooner had his warning been sent than Eagle's Talon banked sharply. Seconds later, a stream of shells tore empty air and exploded harmlessly above it. This was one of a score of warnings pulsing from Adamant's enhanced awareness, the vessels of the Thousand Suns dancing to his directions to evade harm. Each permutation altered the schemata of the future, each consequence rippling outwards, interacting with others in fiendishly complex patterns that only the enhanced mental structure of a specially trained Astartes could process. On another modified Stormhawk, Anku Anen, a fellow disciple of the Corvidae, undertook similar duties. It was not an exact science, and they could not see every danger. Some aircraft were going to be hit, no matter how much the Corvidae sought to prevent it. To mitigate against such immovable futures, every assault craft carried a mix of covens from each cult. High-ranking cultists of the Pavoni and Pirae filled the air around the aircraft with crackling arcs of lightning and fire to detonate incoming shells before impact, while the Raptora maintained kind shields to deflect those shells that penetrated the fire screen. Athenians scanned the thoughts of enemy fighter pilots, skimming the manoeuvres and intercepts they planned from the surfaces of their minds. It was a dance of potential futures, a whirlwind of the possible and the real, each one moving in and out of existence with every passing moment. It was as close as Adamant ever felt to perfection. A nearby explosion rocked the Stormhawk, the shell that had been destined to blow it from the sky, detonating harmlessly off its starboard wing. 2 minutes to skids down, shouted the pilot. Adamant smiled. The dance continued. Camille felt sick to her stomach, but relished the feeling as the aircraft hurled itself to the side and an explosion thumped their underside with a deafening clang of metal. The helmet she wore was dented and uncomfortable, but it saved her skull from being smashed open on the fuselage several times already. "Not like you read about, is it?" shouted Kolophis from the far end of the compartment. "No!" shouted Camille with a forced laugh. "It's better!" She wasn't lying. Though her skin prickled with fear and her heart was thudding against her chest, she had never felt more alive. The prospect of seeing up close what the expeditionary fleets were doing in humanity's name was a unique opportunity. Phoenix Crag was a combat zone, and nothing was certain in a place like that. A chance ricochet, a stray artillery round, anything could snuff out her life in a moment. But what was the point of being alive if you weren't willing to come out of your comfort zone and see what was being done on the bloody knife edge of history? "How long until we land?" she called. 1 minute," said Kolophis, walking down the centre line of the aircraft's ready line with his practicus, a warrior called Yautel, ensuring the Thunderhawk's cargo was ready for deployment. "Are you sure you want to see this? Astartes' war is not pretty for those unused to such sights. Mine is certainly not." "I'm ready," Camille assured him. "And I want to see it. I'm a remembrancer. I need to see things firsthand if my accounts are to be worth anything." "Fair enough," said Kolophis. "Just keep behind the maniples. Stay out of my way, for it's not my duty to protect you if you get into trouble. Keep close to Yautel. He will shield you with a fire cloak. So be careful not to touch anything of value you might find. It will burn like Promethean soaked paper." "Don't worry," said Camille, holding up her gloved hands. "I won't." Kolophis nodded and turned to the muttering tech marine following him. The tech marine consulted a data slate and made last-minute adjustments to the weapon systems of the Thunderhawk silent passengers. Ranked up in three lines were 9 automatons, bulky machines in the shapes of humanoids, but twice as tall as an Astartes. Kolophis had called them cataphracts, battle robots that reeked of grease and a hybrid electric fuel smell. Their bodies were exaggerated and armoured on the torsos and thighs. Heavy plates of armour plaz bolted to piston legs and cog-driven arms. Coloured a vivid blue and gold, their heads were hunched down in the centres of their chests like peak crowns, their carved faces like expressionless masks of long-dead emperors. Each was armed with a long cannon on one arm and a grossly oversized fist on the other. A huge belt-fed weapon was slung behind each robot, and from the greased rails on their backs, Camille guessed they would slide up onto the shoulders when the time came for them to fire. What would she feel from such an inanimate hunk of metal? What purely objective recall might its frame of steel and ceramite yield? She pulled off a glove and tentatively reached out to touch its cold arm. She closed her eyes as the sensations came, the lightless times between battles, the dark, oil-dripping voids between activation and oblivion. She saw through its unfeeling eyes a host of foes falling beneath its weapons, an eternity of war waged without thought for the consequences or reason behind its actions. Camille followed the coursing energy, filling the robot as its power came online, and new life flowed through its cabled veins. She followed the trail of power from its source, feeling the swelling sense of purpose as the robot's battle program came alive, its synthetic cortex processing the instructions that would send it to war. That journey stopped as she sensed a higher consciousness within the machine, a spark of something she hadn't expected to find within its circuits and valves. She sensed a dreadful, aching need to destroy, occupying the higher functions of its part machine, part organic mind. Camille saw a shard of mirror-smooth crystal embedded in the robot's cortex and knew immediately that it had been cut from a place called the Reflecting Cave on Prospero. Just as she knew, it had been carefully nurtured by an apprentice crystal grower named Estica, a man who had that day learned he had an inoperable form of lung blight, but who wasn't worried because a Pavoni healer had been scheduled to come to his home that evening. Seated in the back of the crystal was a dancing flame, an animating will that overrode the robot's childishly simple doctrinal wafer, a consciousness that linked all nine robots together under one supreme authority. The fire burned brightly, swelling to fill the crystal with potency and the urge to fight. The robots raised their cannons in unison, their shoulder-mounted weapons locking into the upright position with a clatter of gears and a wheeze of hydraulics. Then the Thunderhawk slammed down with a jarring thud, and the connection was broken as her hand fell from the robot's arm. The robots turned their faces to her, and a lifeless voice rumbled from the depths of every one of them. The electronically rendered voice of Colophus rasped from the mouthpiece of all nine robots, saying, "Stay out of our way, Mr. Shivani!" The assault ramp blew open, and a howling wind of grit and acrid propellant smoke was sucked inside. The deafening roar of gunfire and explosions filled the compartment. The maniples of robots marched from the Thunderhawk in ordered ranks and into battle. The distinctive snap of wings folding tight into a white furred body was the first warning of the attack. Magnus looked up past the ruin of a smoking tower to see a host of snowshrikes plummeting on an attack run, 30 at least. "Spread out!" he cried, and the warriors of the Scalibur cult threw themselves into the plentiful cover. With a thought, he sent Mahavastu Callimachus into the shadow of a toppled lion statue, the venerable scribe glassy-eyed and compliant. His scrivener harness recorded Magnus's thoughts, the quill-tipped mechadendrites filling page after page for his grimoire. Shards of glass and twisted metal filled the street, as well as the blazing wrecks of Avenian fighters brought down by the space wolves. The shrikes let loose, ululating screams as they dived down through the hail of gunfire. Bolts filled the air, but even Astartes found it hard to hit such fast-moving targets. Mass reactive shells sparked from toppled spires, but only a few of the diving creatures were hit, tumbling to the street in explosions of bloody fur. They were agile flyers, their white-furred bodies like feathered serpents. Their wings were long and flexible, capable of incredible feats of manoeuvrability. Raking dew claws snapped from the leading edges of their wings, turning them into serrated blades. But their long, razor-sharp beaks were their preferred killing tools. Two riders, strapped into flight harnesses, controlled the beasts. One a pilot of sorts, the other a marksman equipped with a lethally accurate long rifle. Magnus watched in fascination as the Avenian linebreakers swooped low through the maze of debris, their riders controlling them with an ease that spoke of a bond formed over decades of shared experience. One of the Scarabaeus cult stepped from cover to take a snapshot, but he had misjudged the speed of the creatures. A shrike flashed down like a glorious chevalier of old Frank, its razored beak like a glittering lance as it skewered the warrior. The blade punched through his chest, and the shrike's gunner fired a repeating pistol into his face. One direct hit punched through the warrior's visor and blew out the back of his helmet. Magnus blinked, and the creature erupted in flames. its piercing shrieks a paltry revenge for the death it had caused. Its riders tried to hurl themselves from their blazing mount, but Magnus pinned them to its back with a thought and let them burn. The other Shrike riders swept through their position, but the Scalibur cult were too canny to be caught in the open when they had other weapons to wield. "Channeling," ordered Magnus, and glittering shapes unfolded from each warrior. Tutelaries in the forms of birds, eyes, lizards, and myriad other unnameable guises. They darted out into the open, and streams of fire and lightning erupted from their shimmering forms as their masters channeled etheric powers through their insubstantial bodies. A score of shrikes erupted into blazing torches of screaming flesh and fur. The survivors fled skyward, and Magnus waited until they had reached suitably lethal altitude before crushing their bones to powder. He heard the beasts' shrill cries of agony, but didn't bother to watch the riders plummet to their deaths. Sporadic gunfire barked towards the Thousand Suns as running Avenian infantry came into view at the end of the street. "Foolish," said Magnus. "Very foolish." He clenched his fist, and the guns exploded in the Avenians' hands, felling the entire line at a stroke. Screams of pain quickly followed, but Magnus paid the awful sound no heed and strode towards the fallen soldiers. Most still blazed with fear and life, but the stamping boots of the Scalibur cult soon doused them. Mahavastu Kilimachus trotted obediently after him, the continual stream of Magnus's thoughts transcribed faithfully into his journal. When this battle was won, Magnus would cull those thoughts into a more artful text for his great work. He reached the end of the street, looking into the sky along a glorious, flying buttress-like causeway that arched out into thin air towards the raised entrance of the Phoenix Crag's great library. Corviday divinations had pinpointed the location of the city's largest repository of knowledge and history, a vast museum housed in a pyramid of silver, 600 meters high and 2 kilometers wide, that rose from the main body of the mountain. The similarity to the great library on Prospero was not lost on Magnus. Dozens of slender bridges led to a plaza before the eagle-wreathed gateway, some shattered in the assault, others on fire, and yet more the scenes of furious running battles. Lehman Russ and his space wolves were mauling the upper echelons of the city, tearing through its leaders and politicians like ocean predators in a feeding frenzy. Vox reports indicated that the word-bearers and Imperial army units had swiftly overcome the defenders of the valley gates and were pushing up through the lower levels of the city, leaving little but ashes and devastation in their wake. Nothing would be left of the city if it were not for Magnus's restraining hand. The Primarchs had met the previous evening to discuss how best to assault Phoenix Crag. Lehman Russ and Lorgar both eager to utterly eradicate the city, though for very different reasons. Russ simply because it stood against him, Lorgar because its ignorance of the Emperor offended him. It would be hard to imagine 3 more different brothers, Russ with a bestial mask he thought fooled everyone with its bellicose savagery, and Lorgar with his altogether subtler mask that hid a face even Magnus could not fully discern. They had spoken long into the night, each of his brothers vying for the upper hand. Phoenix Crag would not be like the other mountain cities of Heliosa, its records destroyed, its artifacts smashed, and its importance forgotten. Magnus would save the history of this isolated outpost of humanity and reclaim its place in the grand pageant of human endeavour. The world had survived the nightmare of old night, and deserved no less. "Onwards, my brothers," said Magnus. "We have a world's legacy to save." The city's buildings were graceful structures built into the fabric of the rock, a maze of dwellings, workplaces, recreational spaces, and interconnecting streets, boulevards, and subterranean passages. To any normal force, this kind of uphill fight would be a brutal building-to-building brawl, time-consuming and wasteful of lives, but the Thousand Suns were no normal force. Adaman maintained his connection to Apio, using his tutelary's link to the ether to shift his perceptions into the near future. He saw traps before they were sprung and read the presence of minds alive with anticipation of ambush. Instead of breaking open each building, the Scalibur cult simply willed their tutelaries into their enemies' hiding places and burned them out with invisible fires or crushed them with psychic hammer blows. Methodical and swift, Adaman's first fellowship pushed upwards towards Magnus, the Primarch calling his warriors to him to defend the city's intellectual heart from destruction. The Thousand Suns fought their way up into the mountain city, along marble-flagged boulevards, each fellowship fighting in the manner of its captain's nature. Phocis Dakar's second fellowship bludgeoned their way straight through the middle of the enemy brigades they encountered, smashing their strongholds with barrages of etheric force while advancing under the protection of invisible mantlets of pure thought. Hathar Mart's third fellowship burned their enemies alive, boiled the blood in their veins or sucked the air from their lungs, turning their bodies against them in spitefully painful ways. Kalophus alone was not summoned by the Primarch's call, instead tasked with securing the Thousand Suns' rear echelons with his chapters of Devastators and battalions of robot maniples. Cyclically resonant crystals allowed the captain of the Sixth Fellowship to direct his mindless charges with complete precision, instead of relying on the Doctrina wafers provided by the Legio Cybernetica. Flocks of Shrikes looped in to attack the Thousand Suns at every opportunity. These attacks were so swift and bloody that not even Adamant's heightened precognitive senses could anticipate them all. The First Fellowship had suffered nearly 100 casualties so far, and he knew there would be more before the battle was concluded. Adamant made his way towards a fallen pillar, behind which Lemuel Gauman was sheltering. He noticed its fluted length was classically proportioned, and the capital was shaped like the leaf-topped columns of the great library on Prospero. Adamant smiled at the incongruous nature of the observation. Lemuel's hands were pressed to his ears to block out the barking shrieks of the alien birds and the thunderous bangs of Astarte's bolt fire. The man's terror fled from his body in streams of greenish-yellow energy. Beside him, Sobek returned fire, the percussive reports of his weapon sending up puffs of dust from the top of the column. "Is it all you hope for?" asked Adamant, slamming a fresh magazine into his pistol. Lemuel looked up, his eyes brimming with tears. He shook his head.
"It's terrible," he said. "How can you stand it?"
"It is what I am trained for," said Adamant, as a booming volley of bolter fire echoed from the walls. Shrieking wails echoed, and stuttering return fire spanked from the top of the pillar. Lemuel flinched as energy projectiles whined past, curling himself into a tight ball. Sobek kept up his methodical volleys, unfazed by the nearness of the enemy fire bullets. A sudden, violent pulse of warning from APO sent Adamant to his knees. The shrike's beak slashed over his head, and he spun his hecker staff up to block a slashing wing. He shot the creature in the face, leaving only a spraying stump as the bolt detonated within its skull. It collapsed as another flight of shrikes dived into attack. A flying killer's claws tore into the column next to him. The stone split apart as the beast slashed its wings at him, dew claws snapping from leathery, kiting sheaths. Lemuel screamed in terror, and the monster turned its long, stabbing beak towards the Remembrancer. Adamant reached out with an open palm and crushed his hand into a fist. The shrike, standing over Lemuel, gave a strangled squawk as its nervous system overloaded with pain impulses. It collapsed into a shivering heap until Adamant stamped down on its neck, spinning around as his precognitive sense screamed a warning at him. He blocked another bladed beak with a sweep of his staff, sending a pulse of fire along its length. The creature shrieked as its body caught light, the flames spreading over its furred body with unnatural rapidity. The flames fed on a victim's life force and would only extinguish when the creature was dead. Sobek battled two of the beasts, his left arm held in the beak of a white-furred shrike as it attempted to soar through his shoulder. The second beast's wings boomed as it hovered above his practicus in a dust-filled whirlwind, raking Sobek's armor with tearing claws. Astartes and predatory killers fought in a confused mass of thrashing limbs, blades, and claws. Adamant swung his pistol around and drew on APO's connection to the great ocean, tracing the myriad potential pathways of the future to follow the path his bolt would take in a fraction of a second. He squeezed the trigger twice in quick succession. The first bolt punched through the skull of the shrike, holding Sobek down. The second exploded the heart of the hovering beast, both impact points less than 10 centimetres from Sobek's body. Both beasts collapsed, slain instantly by Adamant's precision kill shots. "Thank you, my lord," said Sobek, freeing his gouged limb from the beak of the shrike. The armour was sliced through, and the meat of Sobek's arm was bloody and torn. Are you able to fight?
Yes, my lord, Sobek assured him. The wound is already healing.
Ahriman nodded and knelt beside Lemuel. And you, my neophyte? He asked. Lemuel took a deep breath. His skin was ashen, and streaked tears cut through the dust caking his cheeks.
Gunfire still rattled further down the boulevard, but none of it was aimed in their direction.
Are they dead? Asked Lemuel.
They are, confirmed Ahriman. You were in no danger. Sobek maintained a chameleon field around you, so the birds were probably not even aware of you until you screamed. And Sergeant Zaytan protects you from a chance kill with a kind shield.
I thought you were Corviday, said Lemuel. Divinators aren't Raptora of the Telekines.
Most of my warriors are Corviday, nodded Ahriman, pleased to have this opportunity to teach, even in the midst of a firefight. Like all fellowships of the Thousand Suns, each chapter and every squad is made up of warriors belonging to a variety of cults. Sobek and I are Corviday, but Zaytan is Raptora.
Ahriman pointed to a warrior sheltering in a recessed doorway from the sustained fire of a dozen Avenian soldiers. His shoulder guard was emblazoned with the serpentine star of the Thousand Suns with the image of a long, colourful feather at its centre.
And Hastar, over there, is Pavoni. Watch!
Despite his obvious terror, Lemuel peeked over the edge of the column in time to see Hastar leap out into the street as the Avenian soldiers broke from cover. His bolter was clamped to his thigh, and he braced himself with his back foot at right angles to his outthrust left leg. The Avenians saw him and raised their weapons. Before they could fire, sheet lightning leapt from Hastar's outstretched hands, and a deafening thunderclap shattered every pane of glass for 500 meters in all directions. Ahriman's auto-senses compensated for the sudden brightness, but Lemuel blinked away dazzling after-images. By the time his vision had cleared, it was all over. The Avenian soldiers were charred columns of blackened flesh, burned statues kept upright by heat-fused bones. Flesh ran from their corpses like melting butter. Lemuel bent over and vomited the contents of his stomach. Lemuel looked up in horror.
"Sweet Inko Susanna, Lady of Heaven, save me!" he said.
Ahriman forgave the heathen imprecation as Lemuel took several deep breaths and wiped his mouth clean. He spat and said,
"That's horrible. I mean to say, incredible. How did he know those soldiers were going to move at that moment?"
"Because across the street is an Athenian captain named Uthizar," said Ahriman, indicating a warrior crouched in the cover of another fallen column. "He read the thoughts of their commander and told Hastar when they were going to move."
"Incredible," replied Lemuel. "Simply incredible."
Ahriman smiled, pleased that his neophyte had so quickly accepted the fundamental powers of the Thousand Suns. The new Imperium's unseemly rush to embrace secularism and reason had encouraged many of its subjects to abandon their sense of wonder. The new creed denied knowledge of the esoteric, condemning those who pursued such science as unclean sorcerers instead of embracing their work as simply a new form of understanding.
"You are a fast study, Lemuel," said Ahriman, standing and rallying his warriors with a raised fist.
"Now, read the orders and tell me what you feel."
300 warriors, primarily Ahriman's Sekhmet Terminators and veterans of the Scarab cult, formed up alongside Uthizar's plate-armoured warriors.
"Pride," said Lemuel, closing his eyes. "Fierce pride in their abilities."
"You can do better than that," said Ahriman. "A child could tell me that of warriors. Reach out further."
Lemuel's breathing deepened, and Ahriman read the change in his aura as he forced himself into the lowest of the enumerations. It was clumsily done and awkward, but it was more than most mortals could do. How easy it was to forget that Ahriman had once not known how to rise through his states of consciousness. Teaching someone a task he found as natural as breathing made it easy to forget where the difficulties lay.
"Let it come naturally," said Ahriman. "Be borne upon its waves, and it will guide you to what you seek."
Lemuel's face eased as he caught the city's emotional pulse, the fearful black of its populace, the angry crimson of its soldiers, and the underlying golden pride that beat in every heart. Ahriman sensed the violent spike of psychic energy a second before it hit. It swept over them, a sudden, shocking blast of psychic noise that overwhelmed the senses with its sheer violence. Uthisar cried out and dropped his weapon. Lemuel doubled over in pain, convulsing in spastic fits.
"What in the name of the great ocean was that?" cried Sobek. "A weapon?" "A psychic shockwave!" gasped Uthisar. "One of immense proportions!"
Adamant forced the pain away and knelt beside Lemuel. The Remembrancer's face was a mask of blood. It wept from his eyes and poured in a steady stream from his nose. "So strong?" asked Adamant, still blinking away hazy after-images. "Are you sure?" Uthisar nodded.
"I am," he said. "It is a howl of pure rage, cold, jagged, and merciless."
Adamant trusted Uthisar's judgment, tasting icy metal and feeling the rage of a hunter's fury denied.
"Such a force of psychic might is too powerful for any normal mind," said Uthisar, reliving a painful memory. "I have felt this before."
Adamant read Uthisar's aura and knew.
"Layman Russ," he said.